You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 28th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of political economy, the Watson Institute, Brown University, Mark Blythe, on the real meaning of Brexit. Also on the program today, Whole Women's Health versus Helstat. A huge victory for the concept of women having sovereignty over their own bodies. Voisin, meanwhile, keeps guns out of the hands of domestic abusers. And SCOTUS rules that corruption of our government is near impossible. Ladies and gentlemen, we will discuss those topics more in depth tomorrow on the program. But meanwhile, a nearly reborn Christian Donald Trump is on the warpath. He has Scott Brown out there calling for DNA testing of Clinton surrogates. Meanwhile, poll state.
It is what Jesus would do.
Poll show Hillary Clinton up in some instances by double digits. Sanders voters heading to Clinton at a healthy pace. And polarization is at its, well, maybe not necessarily peak, but it's pretty complete. Meanwhile, the DNC platform, as drafted anyways, pretty weak tea. Heads to Orlando for delegates to vote on it, then maybe to Philly. And the 42nd report on the Benghazi Gate is out. And even, what the hell is that guy's name? Kurt Gowdy or
Trey.
Trey Gowdy says, well, Hillary Clinton, well, okay, whatever.
I mean, the point is she's still basically that she's the worst person in the history of humanity.
She just specifically in this instance was not. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Want to get to some sound here. The other day, we played some sound from, is it Nigel Farage?
Is that the guy? That with the NHS sound? Yes, yeah. That was Nigel.
What is it going on with the people in Britain named Nigel? They all seem to be bad people. Is it exclusively? Is Nigel, like, is that some British word for?
There's just a lot of Nigels, I think.
It's all a right, euphemism for asshole.
Yeah, I would stay away from the Nigels if you live in that country. As you recall, Nigel Farage had said, like literally seconds after the results of the Brexit non-binding referendum, that that stuff we said about the NHS, that's the national health system that they have in Britain. Well, that's not necessarily. I wasn't in charge of saying that. That part wasn't me. Well, now they've had Nigel Evans, another member of parliament who is a big Leave campaigner, was on BBC Radio 5, I guess this was yesterday, saying more or less the same about the Leave campaign's promises on reducing immigration. Here is that clip.
What we said is that we would control the immigration into the United Kingdom.
Was it not inferred that if you vote Leave, immigration would go down?
Well, we said we would control it, and that is the most important point.
Control it by bringing it down, Nigel.
No, but no, there are two differences here, and this is where there is some misunderstanding. Dominic and I both stood on a manifesto just over a year ago that we would bring immigration in the United Kingdom down to the tens of thousands. That's what the Prime Minister said time and time again. Then all of a sudden, during the referendum campaign, the Prime Minister informed us all that it was an aspiration, not a promise.
Straight question, straight answer, Nigel. Will immigration fall significantly when the UK leaves the EU?
Right, well, this is one of the things that with the leadership campaign that we're going to have, we will be able to put in place somebody who will be able to look at the immigration system
look
that
at
we've
it.
Got in the UK. Yes,
look
yes,
at
absolutely.
It. You
yes,
campaigned for
an
leave.
Australian points system whereby we can decide the skills that we need within the United Kingdom,
but
instead of...
But the Leave campaign the Leave campaign talked about the pressure on public services in this
absolutely.
Country. And,
absolutely.
And there was an inference, was there not, that immigration would fall if people voted Leave. Can you
absolutely.
Tell people tonight
no, absolutely.
That immigration will fall significantly now that the UK is leaving the European Union?
What I can absolutely say to them is that under the new Australian points system that we will get in place, we will be able to control the amount of immigration.
But you could control it upwards if you chose to, Nigel.
The Remain side pointed out to us that Australia's immigration figure had actually increased. And our counterpoint to that was, yes, it's because Australia has decided they wished more immigration into Australia.
So there you have it. This Nigel basically saying, well, we didn't screw you over as much as the other Nigel. This promise was nuanced. The other one was a straight out F you.
First a lie, the second a...
just a...
just sort of a general screw over, but we don't feel good about it.
Folks, I will say this, in terms of promises. No Nigel here, when I tell you that we are at the Cedar household, which we don't call it. We've never referred to our household as the Cedar household. We are enjoying Blue Apron twice a week. We took 1 week off because you can turn it off for a week or 2 weeks if you want. And you can get it for as many meals a week as you want. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high quality ingredients taste better, and they're better for you. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-proportioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. My kids eat fish, for God's sakes. Like high-quality fish dishes, like sophisticated dinners. One of them's three. Mila, to be honest with you, there's really nothing that we couldn't put down in front of her that she wouldn't eat. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. They set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, we had that one, heirloom tomatoes, we have those, Blue Apron is bringing you the best. Meals available in July. Creamy shrimp fettuccine with sauteed green beans and spinach. Saul's going to love that. Anything that is pasta-based, he loves. Sweet chili chicken with Tinkerbell peppers, green beans, and jasmine rice. Spiced steak, tomato, avocado salad with creamy cone cabbage and red coleslaw. I can tell you, honestly, these meals, the things I love about it are this. This is not part of the, they don't have this in the copy. What I love about it is, A, the portions are perfect. We end up, we get enough for the four of us, and we end up with just enough so that basically we can have it for dessert. Like, there's like half a portion left, and we end up eating that by the time we all go to bed. And the food is delicious. Check out this week's menu. You get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Honestly, folks, They have new recipes created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team. They're not repeated within a year. This is very doable. You can actually be like a great cook. And it doesn't take hours to prepare. And they tell you on the recipe thing basically what you can anticipate, how long it's going to take. 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And they're great meals. They're great meals. Like dinner party caliber meals. But we have them twice a week at my house. And I get Saul to help sometimes prepare the meal. Everybody loves it. BlueApron.com/majority. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Mark Blythe. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the Eastern Professor of Political Economy at the Watson Institute at Brown University, Mark Blythe. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Nice to talk to you again, Sam.
Now, obviously, we're here to talk about Brexit. You were on the program, I guess it was in 2013, talking about your book on austerity. And in many respects, the chickens came home to roost, didn't they, in a way?
They certainly did. I mean, if you think about what's going on in Britain, are we honestly saying that people in the pubs in places like Sunderland are sitting there plowing over the IMF or the OECD report, listening to the chatter in the financial classes about the risk assets and what's going to happen? No, they're basically looking at a life that's been built over 20 years, whereby after the financial crisis, what was already a precarious existence became one where the Chancellor of the Exchequer, our Treasury Secretary, stands up and says, well, we have to cut public spending. Oh, terrible, because we bailed out all those banks. And, like, of course, they didn't really make that link. But people can put two and two together, and when they see that basically the whole financial system and everybody with assets gets bailed out, and the cost of that, as I said in my book, was going to be lower public spending, reduced life chances, and more fractured lives for everyone at the bottom end of the income distribution, then given any opportunity to express the frustration, they're going to take it. And that's what the Brexit vote was in large part.
I mean, so let me see. So in other words, I mean, you see this as the clearest opportunity that people had to basically register their frustration, and it was not necessarily an assessment of the implications of EU policy as much as it was saying we don't like what's happening, and this is the closest lever that we can pull to basically register to raise that flag.
Absolutely. I mean, the American version of this is Trumpism. Right, it's exactly the same phenomenon where you got a bunch of people who feel, with real justification, that one of the parties has led them down the garden path of, honestly, just give me more tax cuts and it'll eventually trickle down to you and it'll be awesome. That clearly hasn't worked for them. And the other one has said, globalization, trade agreements, yeah, absolutely, it's all going to work out fine. You'll be retrained, only they weren't. You'll be reskilled, only you weren't. They were basically left to fend for themselves in minimum wage jobs. And of course, given the opportunity to stick one up at the establishment, they did. Let's think about, get away from Brexit, think about Trump. How does Trump happen? Trump is a joke character. He's like a cartoon character version of what a rich guy should be like. And he's on the ballot. And establishment Republican after establishment Republican comes up. And the Republican primary guys go, no chance, we're not dealing with any of these guys. This is about frustration. This is about anger. This is about being left behind. There's a fantastic paper by an economist called Branko Milanovic on this, and he has a wonderful graph in it, and it shows who has basically done well in the global economy over the past 30 years. And if you're in a really poor country, you've went from $2 a day to $4 a day. You had 100% growth, right? Big in a place like Chad. If you're in China, you went from 35th to 55th percentile. That's real income gains. That's 400 million people out of poverty. The poorest person in the United States starts in the 55th percentile of the global income distribution. And everybody from the 55th down to the 87th has basically lost relative to both the poorest and also, guess what, the top 10%. So I was asked at work to do a video where I could explain very, very quickly, very pithily what this is. And I got it down to 24 seconds. You want to hear what it is?
Please.
All right, here we go. When 80% of the time, 80% of the people are told by the top 20% that everything that they want is what they should want too, but 80% of their lived experience tells them they're being sold a bill of goods, don't be surprised when they say no.
Right. And that's basically what we witnessed with this vote.
That's it. This is what you're seeing everywhere. The collapse of the center parties, the lack of faith in governing authorities, the rise, if you will, of completely fact-free politics. I mean, let's give the Republicans credit. They pioneered that genre 20 years ago and have been mining it wonderfully ever since. But now we've got to the point where anyone who raises facts, actual factual objections, is shouted down because facts are just constructions and they don't really matter. Now, is this because people are stupid or people have real reasons to mistrust the elites? The elites who in our country want to nudge them into better behaviors, who want to police them in certain ways, who want them to behave in a nice way so they don't threaten the established order. And when they do, they're called populists. They're called racists. Now, this is not to say that they're not some populists and indeed some racists there. But this is, again, the denigration of the real experiences of the American working class and how the Democrats in particular have basically sold them down the river.
All right. So just staying in the context of Brexit for just a bit here, give me your sense of how much of, clearly there's a response to a lived reality. How much of that lived reality is a function of in Great Britain? How much of that lived reality is a function of the euro policies, the euro dollar versus conservative and center right liberal policies?
Yeah, so how much of this is to do with Europe and how much is domestic politics that was really their mess to sort out, right? So my shtick on this goes like this. The euro is a disaster, but the EU is a fantastic idea. The EU has taken the rule of law and democracy from the Atlantic to the Balkans. It was fantastically successful, particularly in the period of post-communism. Then they stuck a monetary instrument where one size fits none, and you end up with a deflationary situation which causes mass unemployment, which is where we are now. Now, here's the thing about the Brits. The Brits didn't have any of that. They have the pound. They have an exclusion from ever joining the euro. They were completely in the sweet spot. They're a large economy. They were in the single market. They had their own currency, so they didn't have to worry about all the deflationary dynamics that Spain and France and Greece face vis-a-vis the German export machine. They don't have to worry about any of the silly rules being written in the fiscal compact and all this nonsense that they've written in Europe. And they were able to influence everything. So what they've done, because of the way that the politics of this was sold, was it was all about regaining sovereignty and regaining autonomy. And yes, of course, Britain has ceded sovereignty to Europe in key areas. But let me explain what that concretely means. Imagine you're a British manufacturer. You want to sell stuff in Europe. So you could have one common standard, let's say for environmental protection on cars, or we could have 28 different standards, which would make your costs much worse. So Brussels harmonizes that. And this is seen by the Brexiters as this terrible imposition on British sovereignty. Now, what this really comes down to is immigration. And we should take a separate moment to talk about immigration and migration, because this is a very real concern. But most of what was said about by the Brexiteers about Europe simply is demonstrably not true. And most of it fell within the competency of the British government to do something about inequality, stagnant wages, but they chose to do nothing about it. And they were quite happy to let Europe take the blame, right, even though they weren't in the euro.
Right. So that's a function of basically this is a fig leaf for our policies, which are going to benefit a very narrow bandwidth of our constituents and our donor class, if you will. And yet we get to blame Europe for it.
Think about a year ago, right? The guy who was the Conservative Party, the ruling party in Britain's welfare affairs spokesman, quit his job because he basically accused his own government of doing class warfare on the poor because it was electorally popular and because the poor would never vote for them.
Right. And so
you don't get more explicit than that.
All right. Well, so just explain to people how the euro could have been problematic. I mean, it doesn't seem like obviously because Great Britain is not using the euro, how it hurts these other countries and creates these deflationary pressures. Because I'm looking at, like, for instance, youth unemployment in Europe. Now, this is granted. This is from, I guess, almost a year ago. But in Spain, in Greece, in Croatia, in Italy, above 40% of the youth unemployment.
Trust me, it hasn't gotten any better, Sam. It's exactly the same. All right, so think about it this way, a very simple way to think about this. So imagine that you have this big financial shock, and it suddenly turns out that the Greeks have been lying about their budget deficit. Now, the Greek economy back in 2010 was the size of Alabama. It's now one-third smaller, but nonetheless, that was the size of it. So if Alabama went bust, do you think the United States would go crazy and go into a massive freak-out about it? Absolutely not, because what would happen is people would leave Alabama, and alternatively, there would be financial flows that would come in through the private sector or go out to other areas, and there would be an adjustment in the local budget. Well, that happens because you've got one country and you have fiscal transfers and you have capital markets. And when you live in Arkansas and you move to New York, it's not as if you lose your pension. But Europe is very much an incomplete project. So when you got this shock, and it turned out that the big banks in Europe were using these sovereign debt instruments as collateral in their transactions and they were losing value, suddenly you were looking at a possibility of a massive banking crisis. So that had to be cauterized. So they did this. This is the turn to austerity, et cetera. Fine. Okay, let's go forward 5 years. Why are they still in the doldrums of massively high unemployment? Think about the following. If you're Germany and your supply chain for all your stuff goes into Eastern Europe, then effectively what you're saying to German workers is don't ask for a wage increase, because if you do, I will move my stuff to Romania, and all the parts suppliers are already there. Why do you think you can get a BMW, an incredible car in the United States, for $35,000? Because it's made, the components for it are made in a place which is incredibly cheap and also very skilled. So as the EU expanded eastward and as these countries became part of the supply chain, then they were able to make German parts in particular very, very cheap. So the northern exporters, Eastern Europe, Germany, Holland to a certain extent, they were all running surpluses in the global economy. They're earning money from their exports. Now, if somebody's running a surplus, somebody else has to be running a deficit. It all sums to zero. So that means that France, who's good on services exports but pretty horrible on manufacturing exports, and Spain, who does agricultural exports, they should be allowed to run a deficit to complement the surplus. But they wrote a bunch of rules in 2012 called the Fiscal Compact that says you have to balance your budget, something American conservatives like a lot. Now, if I have to balance my budget when somebody else is running a surplus, the only way I can do that is to permanently contract my economy. So what you're doing is you're causing contraction and deflation in the non-surplus economies to balance out the surplus that you're banking against the rest of the world. That's not good. It's not good economics, and it's certainly not good politics.
And it doesn't seem to be able to end, right? That's the new normal, right? I mean,
this is the model. I mean, the crazy thing about it is, like, you know, you try telling the Germans they're not going to run 7% of GDP as a budget surplus, as a trade surplus, and they'll be like, why the hell would we not want to do that? And from their point of view, it's totally rational, because at the end of the day, the EU is not a country. They are not accountable for the Greek unemployment level. They're just not.
I mean, just so, to just reiterate this so that people can sort of get this concept. I mean, it's almost as if, like, you know, you look at the NFL. There was a long time attempt to establish parity in the NFL. But the fact is, if you have one team that's going to be 14-0 or 16-0 over the course of the season, you have to make up those losses on other teams.
Exactly. And this is also why, to take an NFL analogy, right, the weak teams get the best picks. Now imagine if you end up with a draft system whereby the winningest teams could just continue to pick the best players. All the returns go to one side. There's no way to balance out the other side. Exactly.
So, I mean, how much is the? And I guess the odd thing about this is that it's not a particularly salient wake-up call in terms of what's problematic about the euro, is it, or is it not? Because The Great Britain wasn't a function.
Wasn't even in it.
Right, it wasn't a
they
function.
They weren't even in it.
So what? Well, all right. before we get to what happens next for the Euro project, I mean, what happens? I mean, what do you anticipate happening in terms of Great Britain? And I'm curious as to where you place, where what your sense is of the various sort of political actors here, because it appears that Cameron is basically has sort of reneged on his promised sort of, I guess, sort of the implied threat that, like, we're going to institute Article 50, which would get this process going of exiting the EU, and I'm not going to resign. And he sort of has done a complete 180 on both those promises. In other words, like, I'm leaving this hot potato for the guy who sort of screwed me over in the first place, or whose bait I took, Boris Johnson, and, you know, here's a huge mess. Let somebody else deal with it. I mean, so we're...
No, absolutely. So think about it this way. First of all, like, how can I put it? It would be great if the British governing classes had a spine between them to share. Right? I mean, I've been in the United States for 25 years now. So there we go. I'm a U.S. citizen, and I kiss the ground every day for the day that I joined this wonderful republic. And I left Britain because of a woman. Her name was Margaret Thatcher. But at the end of the day, I'll say one thing for Thatcher. She was a real leader. She knew what the hell she was doing. She was in politics because she believed in things. What we've had since the days of Tony Blair in particular are a bunch of careerists who join up, round-trip the public sector, learn some skills, and then go off and hawk it to the private sector. Practically every member of the Labour front bench from the last government now works in the financial sector for a bank. Mm-hmm. It's a disgrace. So, you know, the fact that Cameron, a man who looks like he was carved out of cream cheese and baked in the oven, has finally said, I don't really know what I'm doing, this is a really stupid idea, that his chancellor has said, I'm not touching this with a barge pole, and then the Labour Party, in classic leftist fashion, has decided to have an internal house-cleaning coup d'etat and general self-destruction party at exactly the wrong moment. It's just classic. I mean, it's incredible. It's the meltdown of one of the most stable countries around. I mean, it's one thing to exit the EU in 1 week, but it's another one to lose against Iceland, lose a football manager, lose a credit rating, and also manage to do Brexit. I mean, that's the quadfecta. That's incredible.
And so, I mean, so give me a sense of what happens next. I see that George Osborne just hours ago said taxes will have to be raised, spending cuts. I mean, basically calling for more austerity. But then he says, I'm not going to do it. I'm getting out of here before any of that stuff goes down, it sounds like.
But one of the really interesting splits in here isn't just sort of, you know, the left behind by globalization and Europeanization versus the 20% who have made out like bandits. There's a huge intergenerational split in this. And then you see exactly the same thing in American politics, right? The young want to stay in this case, right? But at the same time, they don't vote as much as old people, and the old people want out because they want to protect their assets, and a large number of them don't like difference and don't like foreigners. So, you know, take a typical example of an up-and-coming 30-something couple. They buy a house in an area of London that's filled with immigrants because, of course, this area is going to improve. Well, not anymore, because all the immigrants are probably going to be terrified as to what happens next. Investment slowing down, the neighborhood's going to start to decay, and that huge mortgage they took on is suddenly going to be underwater. So on a micro level, for the people who voted to remain, the costs of this are absolutely enormous. Let's not even get into the really complex issues like science and technology funding. £5 billion of that a year came from Europe. What happens to that now? Let's think about Nissan. They have a huge plant in the north of England. Huge numbers of people voted to exit the EU. That's where Nissan makes its cars. They make 10% of their global production in the northeast of England. If their profit margins go down because Britain has to negotiate a deal now where they have to put tariffs on their product, they'll just shift their production to France. It's a question of how much, which foot do you want to shoot yourself in and which gun do you want to use?
I mean, The short-term, mid-term, and long-term prospects for Great Britain seem dim. Is so much of this going to be just sort of like, how do we unwind this relationship?
Let's go back to something you said, Sam, right? Because this is the one hope that we've got, and I'm not that hopeful. Now, you know, I'm against the euro. I'm a strong critic of the euro. I don't think it should have been introduced. I think it maybe fits one or two countries. But Europe itself has its own problems. But we're not talking about Europe. We're talking about the UK. The UK didn't have to do any of this and is now going to negotiate a situation that's going to be worse than the one it found in. And it's going to cause ructions economically and politically, globally and locally because of this. So it's completely unnecessary. Now, what is Cameron doing by pushing this out to, it was October, it is now September. He's trying to induce as much buyer's remorse as possible into everybody who voted to leave. Now, at the end of the day, here's a weird thing about Britain. It doesn't have a written constitution. This is very important. Now, because it doesn't have a written constitution, parliamentary sovereignty is the only rule that matters. If Parliament doesn't vote on it, it doesn't happen. Nigel Farage, one of the main leaders of Get Out, doesn't have a seat in Parliament. And the main parties, even though they're basically collapsing and infighting at this point, have to actually vote on this to get it done. There is no executive authority like there is in the United States where the president writes an executive order and X happens. So Cameron's not going to press the button for Article 50. There's going to be elections. They're going to build up as much buyer's remorse as possible. And they're going to try and overturn this. This is what the internal game, I think, is. Now, here's where it gets really interesting, right? If you do that, the 51% who voted to get out will go nuts because they will see this as hijacking a vote. But that vote was merely advisory. There is no such thing as a legally binding referendum in the United Kingdom. Parliamentary sovereignty is the only thing that matters. So on the one hand, you could do this, but the ructions will be huge. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. If you do that, if you say, okay, we're going to go with this, as Cameron says he's doing at least, we're going to respect the 51% who voted to get out. What about the 61% in Scotland who said we'd like to stay in?
Right.
What about Northern Ireland? Because this is where this gets really interesting, because so Northern Ireland leaves and Scotland leaves, where do you put the nuclear weapons? What happens to NATO's commitment from Britain? What happens to Britain's G7 position? It dies. What happens to its UN Security Council seat? It goes into question. So for all the things that people are worried about in terms of getting back sovereignty from Europe, yeah, good luck with that. You've made Great Britain so much less great.
And so theoretically what could happen in Parliament is that everybody just keeps pointing to other people. I mean, it just sort of feels like everybody's just going to take an extended vacation and wait until hopefully nobody remembers that they were supposed to vote on this this article to initiate the actual exit. Because, I mean, the distinct feeling I get is that everybody was just sort of bluffing. And, you know, like all of them were all just sort of bluffing. Nobody thought this was actually going to happen because they don't seem Boris Johnson on down, none of them seem to really know what they're supposed to do next.
There's no plan. You're absolutely right. But, you know, this is why people should be incredibly worried about Trump. It's the same thing. You can have this spasm of rejection of the liberal and conservative elites, and God knows it's justified. But what happens when you put that guy in charge? And it's the same thing with Boris Johnson. All he wanted to do was dethrone his old buddy Cameron as if it was a debating society match and get control of the Tory party, instead of which he's put Britain on the brink of an economic and political disaster for nothing more than personal envy, ambition, and just being, how can I put this politely, and just being Boris.
What happens? Let's assume for a moment that somehow the inertia continues and Article 51 is passed and Britain begins to extricate itself from the EU. What happens to the EU down the road? I mean, does this send a message to other countries like, look, this is doable, and we're actually getting screwed much more so than Great Britain was? So, you know, if they were a 51-49, we're a 60-40 on this. So, I mean, does this lead to, I mean, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road, an incredible increase in instability? Because I imagine you're not going to get back to that period that we had, whatever it was, 20 years ago, where you have the EU, but you don't have the euro.
Right. Well, you know, you might do if the whole thing blows up. All you need is the National Front to get in France, and they want to withdraw from the euro. At that point, it's very questionable whether it can survive as just a kind of German currency union. So, you know, don't. I mean, Brexit wasn't meant to happen, it happened, so you never know. All right, but let's think this one through. There's two contradictory forces going on in Europe. On the one hand, you have all the people who have gained from the fact that the centre parties have essentially built a creditor's paradise for the top 20% and instantiated it in the euro. That is the SPD, the German left, the French left. They've all done terribly. Hollande's approval ratings are 11%. George W. Bush was three times more popular going out than Hollande is in office. You have to try hard to be that unpopular. The SPD got 19% in the last regional elections. That's their homeland. The European centre-left is dead. It's a corpse, right? So what do you have? You have all of these parties of the left and the right basically eating away at the middle. So the EU institutions, the old guard, the bureaucracy, the Junkers of this world are saying, right, we need to make this unpleasant, we have to make this terrible so it scares people from doing this. Okay, the minute you're trying to build a multi-political union out of fear, you've lost. They need a positive project and they've forgotten what it is. And the reason they've forgotten what it is because they spent the past 8 years since 2008 enforcing a creditor's paradise, which has alienated more and more people from the project as they've protected the rights of creditors and turned the screws on theirs. That's what austerity does. So until they come up with an entirely new project, and it's far from clear from me that Juncker and Tusk and the rest of these people in the EU can actually think of an alternative political settlement for Europe and the euro, they really are in trouble. And the left and the right are going to continue, the new left and the new right are going to continue to eat their lunch. So they are in a really, really bad place. And Brexit has basically put this right on their agenda and they can't ignore it.
You've almost answered the next question I had, but before we get to that, when you say the new left and the new right, just give me a sense of who or what you're talking about.
Sure. So go country by country, right? The new right is essentially the Republican establishment is dead in the water. They couldn't get elected if their life depended on it. Trump's taken over. Let's go for the new left here. So what's happening with the British Labour Party? The entire parliamentary party, all the MPs, hate their leader. Their leader was a guy who was put on the ballot basically as a sop to the left, and he ended up getting 60-odd percent of the vote. All the establishment New Labour people, the membership hate them. They couldn't, some of them couldn't even get into double figures. Now, in the aftermath of Brexit, the parliamentary party has decided to stab their leader in the heart and try and change it and get a new leader. Problem, you need to actually get the membership on board for that, and they're not going to play. So Labour just blew up. The new left in Greece, Syriza, is an obvious example of this. They were the guys that said, no, 61%, we're not doing austerity anymore. Then the ECB turned off liquidity of their banking system, and they said, oh, yeah, all right, we'll do it then, because they had no alternative, thereby undermining democracy and strengthening both the extreme left and the extreme right. Italy, you've got Renzi's in trouble, the centre-left guy, and although he didn't have a breakthrough this time, the five-star movement's still there, the same with Podemos in Spain. In Scotland, the National Front plays a nice game, National Front, forgive me, the Scottish National Party plays a nice game of being the anti-austerity party, mainly because they live off of English transfers, and now that's in doubt. What are they doing? They're screaming like blue murder to get into the EU. Sinn Féin in Ireland. Every country has an example of this. And it goes back to that story I told you. From the 55th percentile to the 87th percentile, people aren't doing well and have actually lost. Their wages have been stagnant. Their costs are going up. The cost to get into college, the cost of healthcare. Meanwhile, your wages, you're living on less and less the whole time. And you're angry and you're fed up with this and you want something different. These people may not offer real solutions, but at least they recognize the problem.
I mean, do you think that there is, I mean, I guess, like, you know, the analogy would be, I mean, do you think there's anybody listening? Like, or is there even an anybody there anymore? I mean, the analogy that occurs to me is, you know, that you had 17 or 16 Republican primary challengers aside from Trump, and none of them could coalesce around anything. No one could recognize what was happening, and they all were acting in their own self-interest, which did not include being the one who would take Trump on head on until it was too late. I mean, do we have that same dynamic? Like, there's no one person or one entity or one group that's really at the wheel in any way. So you just have like a series of individuals who are who share. The only thing they share is just a sense of very, very narrow self-preservation. And there's no one to respond to this.
Well, this goes to my earlier point about leadership. I mean, you know, I was no fan of Mrs. Thatcher, but this wouldn't have happened on her watch. And what we have is, you know, venal self-interest, basic masquerading as a political career. So, you know, this is definitely a large part of the problem. But part of it is you reap what you sow. I mean, if you think about the Republican primaries, they've been throwing red meat to the base for 20 years, right? So, you know, welfare queens, and then it's Mexicans, and then, you know, remember Mitt Romney's wonderful policy of self-deportation? I mean, what's that? Once you identify other people as the problem, and when you forget, of course, that, like, if you hermetically sealed the borders tomorrow, somebody's still going to be picking the tomatoes in Florida, and it's not usually going to be the Floridians. So, you know, what happens when that happens? Well, basically nothing changes, and you realize you've been sold a bill of goods, so you go bananas. You lose faith in these people, and they have every reason to do so. This is also affecting the Democrats. Why is it that young people are completely enthused about Clinton's candidacy? Because they look back to the 1990s, not with rose-tinted nostalgia, but as the period in which we had super predators, three strikes and you're out, globalization, the moment when NAFTA was signed. All of us got the Democrats' fingerprints all over it. And this is where, as far as many people are concerned, when the rot set in.
Do you think that there's anybody in the, you know, the sort of the financial industry? I mean, do you think that Hillary Clinton has an easier chance, or maybe she doesn't even hear this, but that somebody has an easier chance of saying to Hillary Clinton, like, you know, this is all an indication of just exactly what you cannot get away with? I mean, are there any voices out there? I mean, I guess in this country too, where that are delivering the message in a cohesive way, and do you think that there's any sense that anybody's listening? I mean, I guess I'm asking that question again.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to be more specific, Sam. I mean, you know, let's rephrase that one. Is there actually a positive agenda? Well, you could point to Bernie's agenda, but the problem is, with all due respect, Bernie's too old, and the people who are voting for him are too young. And the problem with being too young is not enough of you to show up to vote.
Right.
Old people vote, and old people vote for security for their assets. They don't like change. They don't like foreigners. And when moments of uncertainty come along, they tend towards the right rather than the left. So, you know, there is an agenda out there. But, you know, again, let's think about how this plays out. So the one thing's deeply troubling for me about Clinton's candidacy is the whole issue of the Goldman Sachs transcripts. Now, I've spoken to financial conferences. You can have my transcripts if you want. I'm not sure anybody took them, but if you can find them, I'm fine with it. I'll tell them exactly what I'll tell you. It's not a problem. But if you're not willing to release them, what that says to me is you must have been saying something like, we're all in it together. You're the wealth creators. There was too much credit. We need regulation, but we don't want to kill the business. In other words, exactly what they wanted to hear, and
right,
all of which would be deeply damaging if you're meant to be somebody who's going to take these guys on and regulate them in the public interest. So it seems to me that but the political classes are completely compromised and discredited. And the one person who isn't, who's genuinely exciting, and I don't just mean too old in terms of, like, Bernie's an older guy. I mean, he's old in the sense that his population that he's attracting, people under the age of 35, they are not going to show up in enough numbers, and he's not going to mobilize people on the other side. So, you know, that agenda just isn't going to have resonance at this point. And we see this in the Democratic Party, in the primaries, sadly.
I mean, is there an agenda that addresses these issues? I mean, is it coming from anywhere, do you see, in the context of our political landscape?
Not yet. I mean, put it this way, I read the Financial Times every day because I like to know what the 1% are thinking. And for the past several months, the Financial Times was running these series of articles. The robots are coming. And you've seen this all over the place. It's become a meme, right? So imagine how scary this is, right? So you're a working class person. You're in a state in the Midwest. you're working in an industrial job, and whoops, a private equity firm comes in, buys it, dumps a credit on the books, firm goes public, your job gets shipped abroad. You're good, you adapt, you're fine. You get a job in a call center. That does someone else. It's less wages, but that works. Oh, then your call center gets shipped abroad, right? Well, never mind. There's always Walmart or an Amazon warehouse. Oh, but you know what? You're going to get stunned by a robot soon. This is what you're hearing. Where exactly is any politician, left or right, standing up and saying, you're actually a citizen of the United States. You are sovereign. You are the person that I am here to protect, to help, and empower. And instead of which, I'm trying to buy shares in the robot firm.
In the Financial Times, are they saying, like, are you ever seeing any opinion pieces like, hey, this could be a problem if we bring in all these robots? Or is that awareness?
Absolutely. Okay. No. The one thing about the 1% is they're not monolithic. Many of them are deeply worried about this. But when you've set up a system in which market competition means that the first mover advantage is really strong, if I'm in a sector and I robotize, my profits go up. So all the investment comes towards me. You lose out. You're left carrying my lunch bag. The incentive is for everybody to do it.
Right.
And when politicians have basically boxed themselves into a logic of whatever markets want is good and whatever people want is some kind of error, then it's very hard for them to turn around and do anything about this.
Right. We would need some type of government intervention on the side of sort of investing more in those robots, investing more in their people in some fashion.
Exactly. But to do that, you would actually need to engage with the people and not have some manufactured town hall with supporters bust in where you talk about nice, safe issues that you know that the staid middle classes over the age of 55 care about.
Mark Blythe.
I mean, I'll give you an example. Can we go up? We got 30 seconds?
Oh, yeah. We got plenty of time. Continue.
All right. I'm going to give you this one. Go to President Clinton's website and have a look at the list of issues. Now, it's in alphabetical order, which is kind of weird. But the last time I checked, the first one is Alzheimer's. Now, this is a serious problem, but it's an old people's problem. And it's an old people and families problem that is going to get worse over time. But is that really the thing that's animated the concern for people who are like considering voting for Trump? I don't think so.
Right.
The next one is campus sexual assault. This is a huge problem. We've seen that in the recent court decisions. It's absolutely huge, right? But there's lots of people in America who are saying, I can't even think about sending my kid to college because it's so expensive. Now, further down the list, absolutely, Clinton wants to do something about student loans. But it's not going to be the debt forgiveness of $1 trillion of debt that needs to be forgiven to get young people out of that burden. So we're nipping around the edges. We're not addressing the issues straight on. We're trying to do what the Democrats always do, which is to segment the population, target the people who are going to turn out to vote for you. And while that makes electoral sense in terms of winning the electoral game, it's seeding the agenda because there's no united positive vision that people can get behind. There is no equivalent to saying, let's make America great again. And we need something like that.
Mark Blythe, professor of political economy at the Watson Institute, Brown University. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Cheers.
Cheers. All right, folks. It really holds back.
I was sort of unclear where he was coming from. I learned about the Eurozone, but I didn't really understand his feeling. Like, what does he think of British leadership?
This is a bit within the context of the States. I mean, this has been sort of and I'm at Clinton's thing, and I think he meant instead of Alzheimer's, autism. But it is sort of an amazing. It is amazing that the issues, and there are 20, maybe more. I don't know. How many are here, are listed in alphabetical order. It does not show a boldness. Like, you're not saying, like, this is the priority. Addiction and substance abuse, very important. Is it can't climate change? You know, four or five down the list after campus sexual assault. One of the things that you want to look towards a politician for is to say, like, this is our biggest problem. This is our most pressing problem. And you don't quite see that. I'm not as concerned about Donald Trump in terms of elections. I don't think that we are, but, you know, I guess there's a lot of people saying that about Brexit, too. So, but clearly a problem, and things I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens in Great Britain, because it does, there is a quality there of like no one seems to know what to do. And you just get that sense that a lot of people are just heading for the door. And I'm talking about the political class. Like it's no time like the present to cash this in. Here's my chit. I think it's time. I may make a 7 to 8% less over the course of my lifetime based upon what I had projected.
Advise Barclays on how to deal with the fallout exactly. of leaving of the Eurozone. There's yes. actually really valuable strategic insight that I could provide the city as they reassemble and relocate to Hong Kong exactly. and Singapore.
Exactly. Someone's got to smooth the way. Unbelievable. All right, folks. Just a reminder, it is your membership that makes this show possible. Head over to jointhemajorityreport.com right now and help support this program. I don't know, after that, I just feel like everybody, I feel like we should all just roll this thing up and go home. But even if we do go home, you're going to still need coffee. And so go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off.
Just Brexit. Just Brexit it. It's the stand-in for everything.
Yeah.
What happened with that girl? Yeah, Brexit. Just Brexited it.
Right. So that's the new... Just, it was just... It, there is just a sort of quality as I'm reading this stuff, like, that all of the political parties who were campaigning on this... We're basically like, never thought this was going to happen.
The main
they were all
game,
just sort of like...
Boris, he nailed it. He just wanted to get rid of David Cameron.
Yeah, and I think like... You
and
know,
Nigel Farage, I think, does really believe in it, but didn't actually think it would happen.
Right, I thought this is going to empower me.
Right.
My people are going to be so agitated. I mean, it's basically the same Trump plan, right? My people are going to be so agitated when this doesn't happen. I'm going to blame the Republicans for stabbing me in the back. And within days, I'm going to launch Trump Media. And it's going to be the best alternative media. It's going to put Fox News to shame. But it would be the same thing as if he like, what? I won?
Oh, wait a second. Hold on. I had a business plan.
I got to do the work? No, what? No.
A briefing.
What are you
talking
about?
There's no tens at the briefing. It's not even sevens. It's exhausting. I mean, seriously.
I honestly think that that's
so it's
what
like all kidding aside, a moment of lucidity. I mean, really? I should not be doing this job.
There is. What were you saying? What were you saying before? It's like an Annucci script. Was that what you were saying?
Oh, yeah. This Brexit thing sounds like In the Loop 2 by Armando Iannucci.
Like, whoops.
They screw up and all of a sudden they're not in Europe anymore.
Well, that's been a problem on Veep, actually. One of the showrunners was like, we're planning these ridiculous scenarios, but it's a smart show. So they're still trying to like keep it somewhat within the realm. Yeah. And then they got totally outpaced.
Totally like, outpaced.
Representing what politics used to be.
Yeah. Cause they just can't keep up.
Justcoffee.coop. Also, if you must buy your crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. But if you want to try out a different way of buying your stuff, go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the jet.com link. First time users, I think, get a 10-15% discount. Not sure where it's at right now with that, but check it out. We've got a lot of emails saying thank you for turning us on to Jet. Love it. But either way, you click on the link, you bookmark it in both instances, always buy your crap through there, and we get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about these Supreme Court cases that came in. This whole women's health, big deal, very big deal. And it was, I mean, I curious as to know, like, how much does the absence of Scalia factor into these decisions, even when you factor in the idea that he's not voting for it? I mean, how much, like, does the interpersonal stuff?
He's a forceful guy.
You wonder. Yeah. You wonder. I don't know if we'll ever know, but we'll talk about it with Ian Millhiser tomorrow. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. We have some pretty crazy sound that we'll be playing in the fun half. So join us, won't you? Be right back.